listening to WRCT Pittsburgh and WRCT.org. Welcome to Public Affairs here on WRCT. We have a lot to cover this week, several things in the news, and first we'll go to The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Thanks for being here. Good to be here. Let me say this. Fabulous book.
Thank you.
Filled with such interesting research and unusual and I think really interesting ideas. I mean, does America require poverty to function in the way that we do? Is it a requirement of our society?
Yeah, no, I don't think so.
Does the system we run, do they require in the capitalist system people in poverty to function at maximum profit?
I think a lot of us do benefit from poverty in ways we don't realize, right? We soak the poor in the labor market, the housing market. We continue to have a government that gives the most to families that need it the least by subsidizing affluence instead of fighting poverty.
Right.
We continue to live in segregated lives. A lot of us are connected to that problem, but it also means we're connected to the solution. I don't think we have to live with all this poverty in America.
This system can work. You say something in the book that blew my mind, which is there's a part in there where you talk about the tax burden.
Yeah.
And if we just collected the taxes that were owed,
yeah,
it would account for $1.something trillion. And your calculation of how we could end poverty in this country was how much money?
So if you take everyone below the poverty line and lift them above it, that's about $177 billion a year. And it's a super rough estimate, but it gives us a sense of what we're talking about when we're talking about ending poverty, because that's so utterly attainable for us, right? That's less than 1% of our GDP.
Right.
So a study came out that showed that if the top 1% of Americans just paid all the taxes they owed.
Just the ones they owed?
Just the ones they owed, and not got taxed at a higher rate, just paid what they owed, we would net about $175 billion a year. So we could just about close the poverty gap.
Just with and without levying other taxes, just collecting what we need.
Right. I mean, so like...
So, blah.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
When you say that, I just go, no.
Right.
That can't be.
Right.
But be.
Right.
That's insane. And it's not, the one thing I will say, it's not like we don't spend money
right
on alleviating poverty. We do. The budget for America was what, $3.7 trillion 10 years ago. Now it's like $7
trillion. Yeah.
We do spend the money. Are we just spending it inefficiently?
So I think we have to recognize that the things that we are doing to fight poverty now really, really matter. Medicaid, right, food stamps, you know, housing assistance, these are lifesavers, right? And so these programs are lifting millions of folks above the poverty line every year. We also have to recognize that we have to do more, you know, because the problem's getting a lot worse.
Right.
So over the last 50 years, we've had wages stagnate for too many workers. We've had housing costs soar. We now have the lowest wages, some of the lowest wages in the industrialized world, in the richest country in the history of the world.
Poverty levels are higher than almost all other countries in the industrial world.
They're not just higher. Like, our child poverty rate is double what it is in Canada, Germany, South Korea. You go to Europe, Europeans have this phrase like American-style deprivation. So
I don't even want to know what the German word for that is.
Right.
But it sure it's very long and sounds like someone has bronchitis.
Right.
But this is the part that's shocking. We've done things. I'm going to go back to the pandemic, that there was the ERA, you know, the rent assistance program and the child tax credits. Poverty dropped in the pandemic when people were really suffering by what percent?
So the third rescue plan, the third rescue bill under Biden, signed it in March, right? We dropped child poverty by 44% in 6 months because of that intervention.
So we naturally, at that point, had to end it very quickly.
Right.
That program.
Right, right. Well, a lot of that because we were quiet. We were quiet, you know? We dropped evictions to the lowest they've been ever on record. We did the most for poor kids we've done since the War on Poverty and the Great Society. And there was not a lot of us saying, this is the new America that we want. We weren't writing our congressperson. We weren't talking to our neighbor about it. We were quiet. And in our silence, like 5 million more kids got tossed into poverty the next year. And so I think
Is it a question of when we think about, we always think like, well, for people below the poverty line, there's a ton of programs for them. But I'm a little bit above it, and my parents are getting older, and my kids are going to school, and I'm in a tight squeeze. And quite frankly, I don't want any resources that I might have to pay into. And are there too many people, even above poverty, who are struggling but feel like I'm not getting any value on my return for tax dollars? Yeah. Isn't there a little resource guarding? And by the way, not without cause.
Yeah, there's something to that. But one thing that blew me, I think the thing that blew me away writing this book is that if you look at everything the government does for us, all those poverty programs that flow to the poorest families, like food stamps, social insurance, like Social Security, but also tax breaks. You got to count tax breaks. You know, they cost the government money and they put money in my pocket. If you add all that up, you learn that the average family in the bottom 20% of the income distribution, so our poorest families, they're receiving about $26,000 a year from the government.
Okay.
So the average family in the top 20%, our richest families, they're receiving about $35,000 a year from the government.
Say that again?
So this is the true nature of our welfare state. They're getting about 40% more than the poorest families. And then we have, like, the audacity, the shamelessness to look at a program that would like reduce child poverty or make sure all of us had access to a dentist and be like, gosh, how could we afford it?
Right.
You know,
here's where they go with that. And this is the thing that I would like you to talk about, which is what they would say is, oh, yeah, but the top 10%, 20%, they pay all the taxes. I don't think people understand what a regressive tax system we really have for people, not just at poverty, but working class, middle class, that comes from sales taxes and everything. Right. People pay much more percentage of their income at the lower levels, even though it's not federally taxed.
Right. So, you know, a lot of folks just look at that income tax and they'll say the poor aren't paying taxes. But that's like counting calories only by counting what you had for breakfast.
Right.
You know, and so if you look at the whole tax structure, you see, you know, a lot of the poor, working class, middle class folks are paying the same tax levy as rich folks. The folks that have the lowest tax burden in the country, of course, are richest families. Makes no sense.
But we're not bad people.
No.
So what is going wrong? Is it, if you were Doge, if you were there to say, what how could we do this more efficiently to get people that are struggling to alleviate that? Because in many other countries, they do that.
Yeah.
What would you say?
So I think we got to do three things. We got to deepen our investments in fighting poverty. We got to get back to those big, bold programs that we had in the Great Society. We saw what we could do in COVID.
What were some of those programs that you would?
So we expanded Social Security. We created Medicaid and Medicare. We expanded educational opportunities. These were deep investments in the poorest families in the country.
Right.
So we need to get back to that. We can fund that by fair tax implementation. So the IRS chair a few years ago told Congress that we lose $1 trillion a year, on tax cheating and evasion.
A trillion. Yeah, those poor people are getting away with a ton.
Right.
A trillion a year. And alleviating poverty would be $200 billion a year. What?
Right.
What, is there something in the system of federalism that means those dollars to the poor? Like, if Walmart has a $5 billion or $10 billion profit, and yet still a lot of their workers are on public assistance or struggle, who might not be below poverty line but just above it, how are we not penalizing them?
Right. I think we need to move back to that question, which I think it's this, it's like second piece of the puzzle. We need to have new ways of empowering the poor. We need to find a way to build worker power, to expand housing choice, to finally take on all the ways they're getting financially soaked by banks and payday lenders in the country.
Right.
And so this is a way.
Why is that so hard? Is it that poor people need better lobbyists? Is that what this is? Like, how does this get done?
They need better choice, so they're not accepting the best bad option all the time. So if you think of, like, how are we going to build worker power in this economy? So now you got to go to one Amazon warehouse or one Starbucks location at a time, right? Remember when we were losing our minds because one Amazon warehouse in Staten Island maybe organized a few summers ago, and we're like, oh my gosh. You know, but we have no chance of organizing all our warehouse workers or baristas like this. So we have to have different approaches. So the new labor movement is saying, let's organize entire sectors. Let's get everyone in food and hospitality. Let's say if they take a vote, and that could trigger a process where the Secretary of Labor is like, all right, let's bring worker representatives, corporate representatives, let's hash something out that covers every single worker in that sector. So this is what policy wonks call sectoral bargaining. Mm-hmm. And it's a way to organize all those kind of warehouse workers, all those baristas in one go.
Is there something, too, to getting the government to value labor again in the way that they value capital?
Right.
Capital being taxed at, you know, gains that are much lower.
Right.
There's a lot of rules that ease capital. Stock buybacks. You're only, you know, have to answer to shareholders. Is there a way to get workers in on that? Because that seems like where the accumulation of wealth seems the greatest.
Right.
How do we plug labor into that stream without necessarily killing the stream, but letting it really getting them into the flow of it?
Yeah. Why don't we put workers on corporate boards, for example?
Easy. Easy. Why do they fight that? And would sectoral bargaining get that done?
It could move us closer to something more like a capitalism we deserve, a capitalism that serves the people, not the other way around. And a lot of the times, I think the ideas we have about growth are just wrong. You know, if you rewind the clock, 1960s, we had a higher corporate tax rate, about 50%. About one in three of us were belonging to a union. And we were much more productive as an economy than we are now. And we're kind of fed this like lie that like, we got to slash these unions, we got to slash this corporate tax break, and we're going to get the economic growth. And we win in that bargain. And we got the inequality, but we didn't get the growth.
But don't you think the financialization of our economy changed that calculus? You know, we used to think about IBM, the blue chip companies.
Yeah.
You would invest in them, and they would have steady growth, and they would give you dividends, and you would work for them for 40 years. You know, I was thinking, you know, if you were to reasonably watch the news networks, the little bug in the corner is the stock market.
Right.
Right? If you go to a hospital, they plug you into a machine. It gives you your pulse, your blood pressure, you know, all that. You would be well within your rights to think that is the measure of my health.
Right.
I'm looking at that. When you watch that, you would think, oh, that must be the measure of our economy's health.
Right.
Is there a way to educate the public that that's not actually our economy?
Right.
That's just a tiny fraction that goes mostly to, I don't know, the top 10% own 50% of the wealth in the stock market. What other measures would give people a better sense of how we're failing?
Right. Like, could we have a ticker that's about, you know, the number of families who went to a food pantry this month to eat, right? A ticker that's like the number of families that lost their
homes.
Like a ticker about the number of kids that can't afford a winter coat this winter, you know?
Yes.
And kind of tracking that is like the people's economy.
How many people have parents that need elder care, but it's squeezing them because their kids are going to cut? Like, give a sense of that. By the way, I reopened that cut just by hitting like that.
Oh, no.
Just by doing that. I can't even do this anymore. Are these, critique it now from the left a little bit.
Yeah.
Are there things that the left advocates for or does that makes this realignment harder?
I just don't think the left has fully committed to poverty abolitionism. You know, we know where our local organic cucumber came from, you know, but we don't.
Wait, we do?
We do.
Wait, is it written on there? Do I have to hold it under a blue light? How do we do it?
We know.
All right.
We know. We don't know how much the farmhand got paid picking it.
No.
Yes. You know, if you go to London, you go to the independent stores, they have a sticker on the door, and they say, this store pays a living wage. Now, our stores, we've got a lot of stickers, but we often don't have that one, you know? And so I think that more of us have to just commit.
You're saying we've got to put up poverty has no home here signs?
I think the left needs to get more serious about economic justice.
And do you think, see, I always worry, Here's what I always worry about, and I worry about this with climate. It always comes down to, for some reason on the left, you people just have to be better people, and that'll put pressure on it. I feel like the whole point of joining as a society is that a system can alleviate that. Like, I just don't know how we get out of it without it coming from legislation. I don't know. I mean, when you say, like, we've got to call our congressman, I'm like, I've been in that situation where you call congressman, it does diddly poo. Like, they're not even answering, and half the time they don't even know the ins and outs of what you're talking about. Like, the country's held together by hundreds and hundreds of legislative aides that are working tirelessly. Can't we present them? I would love to see you lobby in Washington, because I feel like you have interesting ideas that haven't tried. We're not walking down the same tired path. Is that a possibility or no? They don't. Are they open to that?
Of me going to Washington?
Yes. Of people like you.
I don't know. I'd have to get a tie.
Do they call you? Did they at least ask? For real?
But I think, you know, that we definitely need more political movements. We need new legislation. But we also need more skin in the game, I think, as a country. So, like, let's think about segregation, right? So segregation is upheld by zoning laws. It's upheld by history. But it's also upheld, like, at soccer games, you know, where your buddy turns to you and you're like, you know, you saw that building. We're not gonna build that thing, right? It's upheld in little...
Oh, you mean NIMBY, the sort of like, we all want economic justice.
For those guys
in the, over there. If you wouldn't mind. But doesn't that speak to that the systems then have to... Here's what I would say. We think of poverty as a vice. And we think of entitlements as a moral hazard for vice. Why don't we view it as investment? Why don't we view... Like, what a great economic engine for this country to take areas that have suffered entrenched poverty and rejuvenate them in a different way.
There's huge investments. So look at food stamps, right?
Yes.
$1 billion dedicated to food stamps get you $1.5 billion in our GDP. If you look at what it does for kids, the long-term economic and health benefit for kids, it's a huge return on investment. It's about $1 in food stamps gets you $62 coming back to you in a society. Meanwhile, right, when we cut the corporate tax rate, the benefits we get are a lot less. We get a lot less than we're promised often when we're doing that. So investing in American people and stabilizing communities that need it the most is the best way for all of us.
I got to tell you, that out of all that argument, that to me was the most concise and powerful, because, and it's one that I really haven't heard, which is, you don't understand, like, we're not just giving people money, we're investing and getting a huge return. And all these corporate subsidies are not getting us a good return. That's fabulous right there. That is anyone watching this? I really appreciate it. This book, if you get a chance, it will blow you. It will open your eyes to a system that can often be well-meaning but not function in the manner that it purports to be functioning. And it's really a wonderfully accessible journey through that. So I really appreciate the book. Be sure to check out Poverty by America, Matthew Desmond.
Next up, we have a segment from the State of the Union and a part of the Roland Martin program with folks discussing the veteran situation.
30% of the federal government are veterans. And Lord, a lot of them who voted for Trump, now they're crying because they're getting laid off. And I'm sitting here going, he didn't love veterans. That man don't care. 30% of the federal government are veterans. And Lord, a lot of them who voted for Trump, now they're crying because they're getting laid off. And I'm sitting here going, he didn't love veterans. That man don't care. He skipped out on the war, and he said, what did he say? He said, trying to avoid STDs was his personal Vietnam. That's literally what that fool said. And so he didn't. So all these people who fell for that nonsense, he didn't love the military. Now they learning.
Yeah, they learning real quick. There's three issues that I take with the felon in chief. First and foremost, this war that he's causing with our allies. He's putting military service members in danger by doing this. They're already saying they're not going to refuel our carriers. Okay, that's just step one. Okay, secondly, all these veterans that are complaining, we voted for him and we're, you know, how could he do this to us? You knew what was coming. He's been saying this.
Even for the folks first at home, you served. How long did you serve?
I served a total of 7.5 years.
Go ahead.
Okay, so Air Force and then the National Guard. So you have these individuals who voted for him who say, oh, we didn't expect him to do this, but he's been saying this. As service members or as military, if our commander in chief says they're going to do something, we're going to assume that they're going to do it. So for them to come back and say, well, we didn't think it was going to be this bad. No, the issue was you didn't think it would impact you.
Boom.
Yes.
You did not Absolutely. Think it would impact you. So that's my third issue that comes up. Now we have veterans who did not vote for him, including myself, who are now being fired, who can't get health care, who are having all these other issues, who served their country valiantly, honorably. And now we have to fight for health care somewhere else because...
And they're doing massive cuts to the VA. They're looking at cutting benefits as well. And so all the Republicans, they all been lying about how much they love the military.
Absolutely, absolutely.
They love to send troops to war, but not take care of them when they're at home.
They like the idea of it. They like to claim that they're patriotic, but they don't follow up with it. And Trump, throughout his first presidency, he made fun of different service members who were held as prisoners of war. I mean, he has time and time again shown that he does not respect the military. And yet we have service members and veterans who still voted for him. And now they're crying. And I see these posts all the time. And I'll comment and say, you know what? As a service member myself, I don't feel, or as a former service member myself, I don't feel sorry for your situation because we tried to tell you. But you didn't care because you didn't think it impacted you. And now it does. And so now we're in this predicament that now we have to try to rally them all together. And we still got veterans who are saying they still support him after being fired by him. I don't understand that. But, you know, at this point, I'm just praying that people will start getting some common sense and start fighting back, whether it's through words, whether it's showing up
right.
protesting. This being nice and sending letters and rah-rah, that's not going to do it anymore. And as someone that's in the military, we believe in force if needs be. So some people need to be thinking, what do we need to do to make sure our voices are heard?
Next up, we have Karen Hunter. And I want to remind you that you are listening to Ebony Spectrum here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
How is everyone? If you missed yesterday's show, I kicked it off in a very, listening back to it very powerfully. Let me just say the show yesterday was pretty powerful. And I'm no Negro Domus, but as I was speaking to you yesterday, it is people who have lived a longer time, who have read and studied some things, maybe more deeply, you start to see patterns develop in society and history. While it does not repeat, it definitely rhymes. And we're in a cycle. We're in a cycle. And I woke up today. First of all, all my stock accounts are in the trash. So I said, Terry Egioma, tap in. What the hell? Okay, so we're going to talk about the Dow falling 800 points. This is, I think, the second worst stock market crash in recent history. And both under this guy. First time under this guy, second time under this guy. And it's around these tariffs, right? And so I was saying, you know, what we had heroin, I broke down Nixon, Ehrlichman, heroin, marijuana, criminalized, demonized, let's go. And then it was crack with Reagan with the crack. And I said, what are they going to do now? Fentanyl. Who knew? And I know that there is a fentanyl problem. But I thought we arrived at the place that, you know, drug use and abuse is a health crisis. I thought we have shifted now that it is white folk, meth, and that. No, now fentanyl. So apparently the tariffs, this is what this administration, and I'm laughing because it's so ridiculous, talking about fentanyl. I said, what? What now? All right, so let me give you the news. Wall Street. 800 points for those of you who have stock accounts. It's about 1.9%. That was as of 11 o'clock this morning. It's steadily falling and rising a little bit, but it's a mess. It was a mess yesterday. General Motors, Tesla's getting, ooh-wee. I'm not mad about that. Those of you who have Teslas, I know there's a whole community of Tesla drivers. Y'all like to do karaoke and all this stuff. I know it's fun. It's a fun car. However, this would be nice to reduce the wealth of one person. You know, do like, I think Sheryl Crow, she traded in her Tesla and then donated the money to NPR. Not that everyone can do that. What is that, Smith?
Turn into Teslas.
Okay, I like that. Okay, thank you. That scared me. I said, who is talking? Is that God? All right, gold prices surged, which makes sense. And I'm like, oh, they playing. Oh, they playing. Fort Knox, gold prices are surging. Fine with me. Canada responded with its own tariff. It's like, oh, okay, I see your tariff and I'm going to raise you. Tariffs, nearly $100 billion worth of U.S. imports. What we don't realize from electricity, some of y'all about to be in the dark. Some of y'all, the light's about to turn out because Canada's like, flip that switch. Yeah, they playing games down there, and we control the electricity for California, New Hampshire, is it Vermont, New York? Mm-hmm. Let me, there's North Dakota. Just turn the lights out. Turn off the light, sweet darling. Yes, I'm not joking. Cotton, soybeans. Oh, China's getting in. China's like, okay, Canada, hold my beer. I apologize. Those were Chinese imports. So the China's like, we too will be imposing tariffs. Now, here's the wild thing. Our tariffs on them impacts us. The people, the purchasers, the consumers, the American citizens, and their tariffs on us impacts us because you thought the eggs were gone? You thought there's no eggs? You about to find out there's going to be not a whole lot of things, but I've been saying you got to stay ready. You got to stay ready. You know, we got to feed ourselves. I've been saying this. Okay. So China, fresh tariffs on cotton, corn, soybeans, wheat, breadbasket, Ukraine. All right, I'm going to put that over there. It's all connected, but we don't have the capacity to see the dots, you know, on purpose. They've scattered the dots, so you're not connecting the dots. The dots mean nothing. It's this. Look over here. We're playing whack-a-mole with our own intelligence. It's not a pretty picture. But China's like, okay, Canada, hold my beer, and then Mexico's coming. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yes, we're coming too. So economists are warning that the cost of the tariffs will likely be passed down to the American consumers. We've been saying this. Even Ferris Bueller's ugly ass. I can't stand this guy, by the way, because he's such a problematic human being. But what's his name? Ferris? Ferris Ben Stein explained how tariffs have failed. Ben Stein is a Trumper, right? I think he's in alignment, so this must have been before. Is this before, during, or after his Trump alignment? Doesn't matter. Oh, this is even more poignant. Okay, so Ferris Bueller, what year did that come out? Because everybody in there is old now. Hold on, let me just do a quick Google search in real time. Ferris Bueller, I'm going to do it right now, Smiz. 1986, look at you, Smiz, knowing the dates. Matthew Broderick, who's now very old. Alan Ruck, who's now very old. Jennifer Grey, who looks completely different now. Jeffrey Jones, who from Beetlejuice, also a little problematic. He may transition. This movie came out in 1986. This is the Ben Stein, the teacher who was Ferris. Ferris, this is what he said about tariffs that nobody was listening to then, 1986. Play it.
In 1930, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, in an effort to alleviate the effects of the, anyone, Great Depression, passed the, anyone, a tariff bill, the Hawley-Smoot Tariff Act, which... Anyone raised tariffs in an effort to collect more revenue for the federal government. Did it work? Anyone know the effects? It did not work, and the United States sank deeper into the Great Depression.
What could go wrong? What could happen here? 'Cause history rhymes, and we're supposed to be smart enough to say, hey, that happened then. Let's not do it again because it didn't work then. What makes us think it would work now? But, you know, I had a light bulb moment yesterday. We had Terry Williams on, White United Bank president. And I said to her, because she was like, the FDIC, that They couldn't get rid of that because that would mean the collapse of the entire financial system. And I said to her, if y'all listened yesterday, what if that's the plan? And if you could see her face in real time, it was as if she had not considered that the president of the United States might actually be conspiring to dismantle the United States of America from the inside out. Didn't dawn on her, because who would do such a thing? I mean, you're the president of this. You're the carekeeper of this United States. How could you? Why would you do things to undermine it? Unless you are actually a Russian op. Unless we are an annex of Russia now, which it seems like that might be the case. The former ambassador to Russia, he posted on social media today, and I was like, oh, shoot. Michael McFaul, MCFAUL, Michael McFaul, diplomat, served as the United States ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 2014. This is what he posted. Journalists need to stop accepting this false frame from Trump that he is trying to negotiate a peace deal between Ukraine and Putin. He is not. He is throwing the Ukrainians under the bus and embracing Putin. This is not mediation. Why would you do that? I'm old enough to remember listening to stories of the Bay of Pigs and, you know, people hiding under desks because of the communists. And isn't that why we went to Vietnam? To stop the spread of communism. Russia, you know, from Rocky on, Russia's the problem. Now we are literally in bed with the Russians, and we got Tulsi garbage and all of this. This is craziness. This is crazy. This is absolutely crazy. And this is where we are. So we're going to talk about solutions, because this is how I'm rolling. But in addition to China, Canada retaliated. We are already feeling it. Those of you who like maple syrup, as I do, like pure maple syrup, all the people that like to drink, get your drink on. Canada's like, ha, good luck. In addition to all the other things. Now, here's what you need to know about fentanyl. So Trump, the justification is you are flooding our borders with fentanyl. Canada, Justin Trudeau had facts and stats, which are important. He said no justification because less than 1% of the fentanyl interception at the U.S. border has come from Canada. Less than 1%. This is not about fentanyl. Earlier Monday, the foreign minister from Canada, Melanie Joly, or Joly, J-O-L-Y, she reported that Trump's tariffs represented, quote, an existential threat to us because jobs are at risk, because tariffs hurt people. Now they have to retaliate with tariffs. And the immigration minister, Mark Miller, warned that as many as 1 million jobs in Canada were at risk if the tariffs are implemented, given how intertwined trade is between United States and Canada, including electricity, people about to be in the dark. They said, we can't replace an economy that is responsible for 80% of our trade overnight. It's going to hurt. But you know who's going to really hurt? People who already can't get eggs. I went to the store on Sunday, and there were no eggs at all in my favorite store. So I was like, let me try the next store. And it was sparse, but the eggs were there, and they were $12. I'm paying $1 a egg. I know it's an egg. $1 a egg. $1 per egg. And I bought two because I, you know, that. And I don't even really eat eggs that much. I'm like, am I the problem? Probably. This is terrible. So consumers, we, people who buy stuff, isn't it nice to be in a financial fast, though, a little bit? So people who buy stuff will be seeing higher prices on gas, according to Gas Buddy, 40 cents per gallon, as if. I read somewhere it could be as high as $6 a gallon. That is untenable, $6 a gallon, if you take super. What about the truck drivers? How is that going to be passed? Because they need to fill up. So we're going to now shout out to my truckers out there. I would love to know how this is going to impact y'all. But goods and services, including cars. We were just talking about, I forgot who I was talking with, about the car prices dropping. Remember during COVID, it was like there was too much, there weren't enough cars, and so the used cars, the pre-owned cars were very expensive. Well, that has reversed in the last few months, and I think that's going to reverse again. U.S. imports, $45 billion of agricultural products come from Mexico. Almost three-quarters of vegetables, fruit, beer, tequila, other drinks, and spirits, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. At the same time, U.S. imported roughly $40 billion worth of Canadian agricultural products as well, including beef, pork, grains, potatoes, canola oil, which we shouldn't be using anyway. I'm going to say less about that, but y'all know already. And according to the Atlanta Fed, the tariffs on three key U.S. trading partners, we're talking Canada, Mexico, and China, would bring up prices on everyday purchases, including food and beverages, by as much as 1.63%, which the businesses, of course, will be passing along to me and you. You know, because as if they weren't price gouging, they don't have to do this, by the way. All of these grocery stores, they don't have to raise. Y'all already raised the prices on us. You already are doing that. So be a good citizen? I doubt it. These are capitalists with a capital C. But those of you who are in the market to buy a car, those are going to be hit the hardest, some of the hardest. So as much as $12,000 more on some models. So, you know, we are here. We're going to pay attention. I don't think I'm prophetic at all. But I do think we should be paying attention. This is what it looks like. And this is how you can prepare for times, because you can see, they call it reading the tea leaves. But no, we got this person in who told you what he was going to do. We've been talking about Project 2025 for at least a year before the election. It was like, this is happening. I mean, some, like LaRee and Clay, y'all, they were reading from it on a regular basis. And the goal back in 2016, because I sat with Steve Bannon, was to dismantle this government. He wanted to get rid of the Department of Education and all these departments, the post office, everything then. Now they can run a Boston. They have the House, they got the Senate, and they have the judiciary and the Supreme Court. And the executive branch, with the guy that has the third grade education and can't read, but he has the executive order pen too. What are we doing? Well, we have to double down on us, double down on community, pay attention to one another, love one another, but also make sure we have each other's back, because some winter is here. It's not just coming, it's here. It's snowing. It's a blizzard.
Next up is Chris Hayes from MSNBC.
Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes. Not surprisingly, Donald Trump told a bunch of lies last night in his joint address to Congress. There were small lies, there were big lies, and then there's the big lie. And that is a coordinated campaign of blatant falsehoods to systematically burn down and destroy an institution. We saw Trump do it in 2020 before our very eyes, undermining the legitimacy of America's free and fair elections. We saw him do it last night on the biggest stage, undermining the legitimacy of America's most important safety net for its citizens, Social Security. There is a pattern to what Trump is doing and what he's goading other Republicans into saying. It is a pattern Trump established throughout the 2020 election and its aftermath, all the way up to January 6th and beyond. A deliberate attempt to alter reality with lies about the balloting that were so audacious and so obviously untrue.
They're sending millions of ballots all over the country. There's fraud. They found them in creeks.
We caught them, as you know, as fraudulent, dropping ballots, doing so many things nobody can even believe it. Dead people voting.
It was a massive dump of votes.
And then you get to Detroit, and it's like more votes than people.
We have a company that's very suspect. Its name is Dominion.
This election was lost by the Democrats. They cheated. It was a fraudulent election. They flooded the market.
Now, to be clear, those claims were all false. They were laughed out of court dozens and dozens and dozens of times. But Trump was obsessed with convincing his fan base that the voting system in the U.S., gold standard for free and fair elections around the world, was shot through with fraud. I mean, in numbers that were preposterous. And it wasn't a new obsession. I mean, look at these headlines. Donald Trump warns vote could be rigged, Trump ratchets up rigged election claims, which Pence downplays. Donald Trump's rigged election claims raise historical alarms. All of these headlines were from the 2016 election campaign, the election Trump ultimately won in the Electoral College. He didn't challenge that outcome. But once he lost in 2020, Trump went back to his old playbook, this well-established playbook, particularly the myth of dead people voting for Democrats. This has been a fringe right-wing talking point for years, and Trump elevated the lie to new prominence. He used it in his, quote, perfect phone call with Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to pressure his fellow Republicans into basically a coup, into rigging the state's vote totals to favor Trump, even though he lost the state. And Raffensperger debunked that lie in his testimony to the January 6th committee.
The other thing, dead people, so dead people voted, and I think the number is in the close to 5,000 people, and they went to obituaries, they went to all sorts of methods to come up with an accurate number, and a minimum is close to about 5,000 voters.
So, Secretary, did your office investigate whether those allegations were accurate? Did 5,000 dead people in Georgia vote?
No, it's not accurate. And actually, in their lawsuits, they alleged 10,315 dead people. We found two dead people when I wrote my letter to Congress that stated January 6th. And subsequent to that, we found two more. That's one, two, three, four people, not 4,000, but just a total of four.
Now, Trump's lies had a purpose, right? The purpose is to destroy faith in the electoral system so as to overthrow American democracy. To destroy that faith so that you can destroy the institution itself. And he rolled out the same play last night as he blasted out his new big lie about a beloved government program, one that Republicans have long hated, but that 71 million Americans currently rely on.
We're also identifying shocking levels of incompetence and probable fraud in the Social Security program. Believe it or not, government databases list 4.7 million Social Security members from people aged 100 to 109 years old. It lists 3.6 million people from ages 110 to 119. I don't know any of them. I know some people that are rather elderly, but not quite that elderly. But we're going to find out where that money's going, and it's not going to be pretty.
Identical, right? He sees dead people again. The dead people voting in the Georgia election, the dead people getting checks from Social Security, all the dead people committing fraud. Suggesting that Americans who died long ago are still having their Social Security checks delivered to someone and somehow cashing them in their name, even though they're dead and there's a death certificate. Again, think about it for 20 seconds. It's obviously preposterous. In fact, a government investigation last year found that from 2015 through 2022, 7 years, of all the money the agency paid out in benefits, and that is $8.6 trillion, a staggering sum, less than 1% was improper payments. That's a really good record. And most of the erroneous payments were overpayments to living people. I mean, again, think about this, right? In the same way you, if you think through the dead people voting at scale issue, if you have ever had a loved person die when they were on Social Security, you know the checks don't keep coming. Also, Social Security automatically stops payments to people who are 115 years old. It's capped there, which I'm sure is a bureaucratic headache for the handful of Americans who live that long. The version of the lie Trump and his unelected co-president Elon Musk are telling appears to be based on their inability to read the data they collected, because Social Security's software system necessitates that some entries with missing or incomplete birth dates will default to a reference point of more than 150 years ago. I don't know the origins of this, but here's the thing. The fraud claims are bunk. They're totally false. It's just the big lie about voting again. Dead people voting. But just like they did with the election big lie, Republicans are amplifying it.
What he's finding with his algorithms crawling through the data of Social Security system is enormous amounts of fraud, waste, and abuse.
Tens of millions of deceased people who are receiving fraudulent Social Security payments.
More than 13 million people on the records receiving benefits who are over 119 years old.
I'm shocked enough Who do we have at 200 years old, or who do we have older than America that's getting Social Security?
Everybody whose grandfather died and is still getting Social Security? Give me a break.
Yeah. They're lies. They are lying. Those are all lies. It's not happening, okay? Millions of people? Millions? Here's the thing. They want to destroy Social Security. They are coming for Social Security. Musk has already installed someone from DOGE at the Social Security Administration. The agency has already announced enormous layoffs. They're already closing offices. This is going to make things start to break there. Last weekend, the previous Social Security Administrator, Martin O'Malley, warned that Trump and DOGE were breaking the whole agency, saying, quote, ultimately, you're going to see the system collapse and an interruption of benefits. I believe you will see that within the next 30 to 90 days. People should start saving now. Like, I don't know if that's a credible prediction. I really don't know. Social Security is an amazing and robust system, right? But it's an incredible statement. Given that Social Security has never missed a monthly payment in 90 years, it is a program, like our voting system, that is incredibly free of fraud, incredibly efficiently run, insanely popular with the American populace, just like free and fair elections. So keep your eye on the ball here, right? Huge tip-off last night of what they're about to do. Trump knows all this. Musk knows all this. It's why they are telling the big lie about Social Security, just like the big election lie. The objective now, as it was then, is to fabricate this elaborate, grotesque lie about a cherished institution of American government to sow enough fear, doubt, and uncertainty among enough people that Trump can get away with destroying it.
I want to remind everyone that you can listen to Ebony Spectrum and In Black America through Public Affairs here on WRCT on Sunday mornings from 5 until 6, right before the jazz show, on Monday mornings, and also on Thursday mornings, all of them before Democracy Now! On Mondays and Thursdays. Next up, we have Don Lemon and Lemon Drops.
Let's talk about the latest chapter in Donald Trump's ongoing war against reality, because if this second Trump administration is defined by anything, it is the inability to accept even the most obvious and most basic truths. The American people are mad as hell. They're furious. Furious about Medicaid cuts, furious about mass layoffs, furious about planes falling right out of the sky. Furious about Trump's betrayal of Ukraine.
The other one is the DOGE program. That's
Now, a competent Republican Party would take this feedback and they would course correct. Well, they'd view this as constructive criticism. They'd meet the moment and they'd adapt. But here's the thing. The MAGA movement has destroyed the Republican Party. The GOP is now just a cult of personality. And to course correct would mean admitting that Donald Trump made a mistake, that Donald Trump is wrong. Can't do that, right? Nope. So there's only one move that you can make. Say that the protests, the people in the streets, that the anger, that the town halls, that they're all fake. They're all a conspiracy. They're all a Democratic mirage. I want you to look at this tweet, okay? Paid troublemakers are attending Republican town hall meetings. It is all part of the game for the Democrats. But just like our big landslide election, it's not going to work for them. Yes, according to Trump, these are not real Americans who are fed up with his policies. No, they are paid troublemakers. Apparently, when people boo Republican lawmakers out of their own town halls, when they chant, vote him out in deep red districts, it's not because they're mad. It's because George Soros or some other conspiracy theory that he's cutting checks or something. Where have we heard this before? All right. Well, it was a 2020 election when millions of Americans voted against Trump. Trump couldn't accept it. So he called it a fraud. He called them a fraud. He lives in a world where reality must always conform to his ego. And if it doesn't, well, then reality itself must be rigged. But here's the real truth, people. People are angry. They're watching Republican lawmakers slash billions from Medicaid and Medicare while passing tax cuts that overwhelmingly benefit corporations. They are seeing Elon Musk handed unchecked power over federal agencies, gutting essential programs, and firing thousands of federal workers, including 6,000 veterans. And they are showing up at those town halls, at those rallies, at meetings to demand accountability. In Kansas, Senator Roger Marshall was booed so loudly that he had to cut his town hall short. In Texas, Representative Keith Self was shouted down for so long that he could barely get a word in. At one point, the crowd broke into an impromptu standing ovation, but not for him, but for the idea of voting him out. And in Tennessee, Representative Diana Harshberger tried to insist that the people overwhelmingly voted for Trump, only to be met with a chorus of no from the crowd. These aren't Democratic operatives. These are constituents, and they are done being ignored. But Trump and his allies, they can't admit it. Listen to House Speaker Mike Johnson.
Because we've seen this movie before. George Soros-funded groups and others literally pay protesters. And, you know, I saw my friend Hakeem Jeffries decrying that I've said that, but we know that that is a fact. Democrat activists who don't live in the district very often will show up for these town hall events, and they'll go in an hour early, and they'll fill all the seats. And so the constituents and the people from the community that are actually represented don't even get a seat.
Do these people even hear themselves? Do they understand how deeply stupid they sound? They are so insulated in their bubble of Doge delusion that they cannot fathom their own voters turning on them. But that's exactly what is happening. And to quote Mike Johnson, we have seen this movie before. It was in 2009 with the Tea Party.
American flags, patriotic songs, and a call to action. All part of tonight's Tea Party rally on the north steps of the Capitol. A rally dubbed Take Back America.
The liberal progressives are intent on the radicalization, the transformation of America, and they are scared to death of the growing momentum of citizen patriots like yourselves.
Democrats dismissed the Tea Party protests in 2009 as fake. They laughed them off. The Democratic establishment scoffed. They were convinced that the movement was nothing more than corporate-funded astroturf. Sound familiar? And then what happened? The Tea Party took over. They didn't just show up to those town halls. They organized. They built coalitions. They ran for office. And in 2010, Democrats suffered one of the most brutal midterm losses in modern history, losing 63 seats in the House, handing Republicans control. That so-called fake outrage reshaped American politics for a generation. It gave rise to the hard right, obstructionist wing of the GOP. It laid the groundwork for Donald Trump himself. The Tea Party movement reshaped the country as we know it. It bulldozed the Republican establishment. It forced longtime incumbents into early retirement. It pushed moderates out of the party and made compromise a dirty word in Washington. So the movement's influence stretched beyond Congress, it fueling the rise of hyper-partisan media, giving oxygen to conspiracy theories and fundamentally shifting the Overton window so far to the right that policies once considered extreme became mainstream Republican doctrine. And yet, when it first emerged, Democrats dismissed it as corporate-backed BS. A flash of anger. No real popular sentiment behind it. They underestimated it, and they paid dearly. Now the GOP is walking straight into the same trap. They are looking at packed town halls, at voters furious over Medicaid cuts, job losses, and corruption, and they are saying, this isn't real. They are ignoring the lesson they should have learned in 2010. When people are ignored, they don't just complain. They mobilize, they organize, and they vote. If history is any guide, this movement isn't an anomaly. It's the beginning of a reckoning. And the Republican Party, like the Democratic Party before them, they might soon learn just how real this outrage actually is. Here's the bottom line, okay? The American people don't need to be paid to be furious. They don't need marching orders from the DNC to show up and demand that their representatives actually represent them. And no amount of conspiracy theories, no amount of spin is going to change the fact that this administration is governing for billionaires, for corporations, for themselves, not for the people they were elected to serve. And that, my friends, is the real fraud.
Locally, the new hunt for another Pittsburgh police chief.
Continuing coverage now, the search for Pittsburgh's next police chief
is now back to square one. Later this afternoon, Acting Chief Christopher Raglin will be speaking about his decision to retire and not take up on the job as chief. But in the meantime, as KDK's Lauren Linder is finding out, the situation and back-to-back searches for a chief is creating some strong feelings among the public.
The Pittsburgh Bureau of Police is without a chief once again after Mayor Ed Ganey's pick for the top cop retired and stepped down as acting chief. Now it's back to the drawing board, and folks across the city have their own feelings about what they're looking for.
I'm frustrated because I don't see anything getting any better.
Mary Tolomeo is concerned for Pittsburgh and the safety of folks throughout the city.
It seems everything is getting out of hand.
Knowing many people directly impacted by crime.
When I know people of having fights and shootings near their homes, and they don't feel safe in their own homes.
And with Mayor Ed Ganey back to square one in the search for a police chief, she's ready for change and more stability up top. After Acting Chief Christopher Ragland withdrew his candidacy for the job on Tuesday, and former Chief Larry Scarrato suddenly retired to become a full-time basketball referee last fall.
We need more consistent leadership in our police.
Reliability is also what Joyce Boyle is looking for. She lives on Mount Washington, where, like other neighborhoods, folks are facing an ongoing car theft and break-in problem. And on top of that, she's tired of what she says are long response times.
We've had shots up there, like, you know, shot spotters go off, and they take 45 minutes to get up there sometimes.
For Ken Grabowski, who frequently visits the city from Shaler, it's about protecting folks downtown. He still doesn't feel comfortable out in some areas during certain times of the day.
Make it the ability for people to come down to Pittsburgh again and be safe to walk around the streets.
As he resigned, Raglin suggested his nomination became a victim of politics. People say they're losing trust in the process.
Everything is becoming political. So, yeah, I'm losing confidence in whoever comes in is really going to do what they expected to do.
In Pittsburgh, Lauren Linder, KDK TV News.
All I'm going to say is that during this process, I didn't feel that I could lead the Bureau in a way that was morally and ethically in line with my thoughts and desires.
KDKA's Jennifer Barrasso following the story for us from Pittsburgh Police Headquarters. She spoke to Mayor Ganey about his police chief pick's decision to drop out. Jen.
That's right, Jess. So Pittsburgh Mayor Ed Ganey speaking for the first time about this sudden resignation. The man he nominated to be the permanent police chief. The mayor was at a public safety forum in Carrick tonight where residents brought up the resignation.
He deserves to be treated better. So when he came to me and told me, listen, this is having an impact on my family, this is having an impact on my mom, it meant something to him. I think that it just got too much. You know, I mean, I'll be honest, we wanted him, but, you know, going through that whole process of again and again, he got to answer this question, he got to do this, that, and the third. Another chief was going through that. He shouldn't have had to go through that. No other chief coming through went through that.
You asked him about 2 weeks ago, Chief, do you want this job? And he answered, yes.
Yes, he did.
What happened?
That's what happened. What happened was the process kept switching up. They kept putting on more demands. They kept trying to make situations where, you know, they wanted, he just was uncomfortable with the
city
process.
Council, you mean?
You heard him say it today, yes, city council.
Christopher Raglin says he grew frustrated with the process when city council delayed his confirmation and community groups called for 6 neighborhood meetings. City council would interview Raglin, and that interview process would be under oath, something that has never happened before. Council made that change after the last police chief, Larry Scarrato, decided to pursue refereeing for college basketball. He was on the job for only 14 months. Raglin, meantime, also suggested a member or members of council wanted him to promote certain people in exchange for their approval to make him chief. He says while this process was playing out, he didn't think he could lead the Bureau morally or ethically, and that he said that his nomination had become a political football that wouldn't get decided before the primary election for Pittsburgh mayor in May. And tonight, I spoke with the other three mayoral candidates about this. Take a listen.
He wanted the job, and now he just doesn't. And this is one of the things that we're used to in Pittsburgh is there's no transparency in city government whatsoever.
How the mayor was portraying it is this individual wanted the job. This individual was his choice. And now his choice is bailing out on the city of Pittsburgh.
I feel bad for the police officers because there's disarray in our department. They now feel like they're being ridiculed. We can't keep a chief. Our leadership can't make a decision.
And Mayor Ganey wouldn't say exactly when Christopher Raglin told him that he was pulling out, that he was resigning. And meantime, Assistant Chief Marty Devine will take.
Get started. I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Now, going through with these cuts will make the world less healthy, less safe, and less prosperous. The reduction of America's humanitarian role and influence will run counter to American interests globally.
UN officials and senior USAID leaders are warning hundreds of thousands of people could die across the globe as President Trump cuts off funding for critical programs fighting AIDS, malaria, polio, and more. On Wednesday, Trump suffered a setback as the Supreme Court rejected his bid to freeze $2 billion in foreign aid. We'll speak to a lawyer from Public Citizen and the head of the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, which sued Trump. Then Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Brett Murphy at ProPublica.
We found internal memos that were detailing the millions of lives that were at stake and the warnings that were put in front of the Secretary of State. Instead of heeding those warnings, the top leadership thwarted a lot of those people inside of the agency.
We'll also speak to the South African anthropologist Catherine Mathers at Duke University. She says the humanitarian industrial complex should be dismantled, but not by a billionaire-backed administration with no plan beyond abandonment. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump suffered a setback at the Supreme Court Wednesday when justices issued a 5-4 ruling rejecting a request by the Trump administration to keep frozen $2 billion in foreign aid. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett joined the court's three liberal justices in the majority. The case was brought by the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition and other groups who are seeking to unfreeze foreign aid that had already been appropriated by Congress. In its one-paragraph ruling, the court instructed Federal District Judge Amir Ali to, quote, clarify what obligations the government must fulfill in order to comply with a temporary restraining order the judge issued on February 13th. Judge Ali has faced numerous threats over the past month after he ordered the Trump administration to restore the $2 billion in funding. In late February, Trump advisor Elon Musk called for his firing, writing, quote, when judges egregiously undermine the democratic will of the people, they must be fired, unquote. Several users on the Musk-owned social media platform X have also posted death threats against Ali. We'll have more on this ruling after headlines. President Trump's expected to issue an executive order as early as today to start dismantling the Department of Education. Although it would take an act of Congress to fully dissolve the agency, a draft presidential memo orders Education Secretary Linda McMahon to take all necessary steps permitted by law. Those steps are likely to include cuts to the workforce and education programs. This comes as the country's largest labor union, the National Education Association, and the ACLU are suing the Education Department for threatening to withhold federal funding to schools that engage in DEI efforts. That's diversity, equity, and inclusion. The ACLU called the Trump administration's move, quote, a blatant attack on free speech and academic freedom, aiming to deprive students of a full and honest education, unquote. The Department of Veterans Affairs is moving to slash some 80,000 jobs. The VA's labor force grew under the Biden administration largely to help implement the PACT Act, which expanded benefits for veterans exposed to toxic burn pits. Meanwhile, a federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from cutting National Institutes of Health research funding, siding with 22